into his empty boots, then sat up and began pulling them back on.
You don't understand how it is these days, Mr. Navarre.
I understand two people have been murdered. I understand Tilden Sheckley's got some illegal business going on, which he's very anxious not to have uncovered. I understand he's playing you for a fool, giving you the pissant jobs of shaking me down, doing surveillance on the least important places where Les has already been scared away from. What am I missing?
He's chicken, Allison said.
Frank stared at her coldly.
You don't know me to say that. You don't know Sheck or what he's dealing with.
Allison laughed.
Like he's a victim?
Frank's fists closed up and his eyes became unfocused. Something about his response bothered me. His anger turned into something more like embarrassment. The walkie-talkie on his belt clicked. He and I exchanged looks.
I see two options, Frank. First is, you help me out, tell me what's going on. Maybe I can help you get to some people who will listen to your problems. The second option is, you let Elgin in on this party, and we see where it takes us. Which can you live with easier?
Allison straightened up, smiling slightly, indicating that either option was just fine by her. Frank stood. He looked around the tossed-up cabin one more time, then decided on a third option. He picked up the walkie-talkie and turned on the volume.
Yo, Elgin, I'm trying again. I thought I saw something.
He took his finger off the button.
You folks got 1 minute.
Allison pouted. It took a look of absolute steel for me to persuade her away from the kitchen counter and out the door. As we walked past Frank, his eyes stayed fixed on the back window. When I turned around in the doorway, he was still standing like that, like a soldier at attention. Chapter 39. Allison and I hardly spoke on the boat ride back. We docked at Turk's, thanked Bip for the rental, and sloshed into the store with our lake water-filled shoes. We went our separate ways in the little dusty aisles, then met back at Eustace's cash register. I had nacho-flavored Doritos and a knee-high orange. Don't ask me why. When I'm stressed and disoriented, I pick orange food. Never planned. It just happens. Sort of a dietary mood ring. Allison had a 20-ounce bottle of fortified wine. I stared at the bottle, then at her.
What? She demanded.
Death wish?
Fuck you.
Eustace shifted uncomfortably, tried to smile.
Y'all have a nice evening.
We drove south, skirting the lake and heading toward the dam. The late afternoon sun was slicing through the tops of the live oaks, making the road furry with shadows and the lake glaring silver. Allison drank her grade A stomach destroyer and pushed my mother's purple glasses farther up on her nose and watched the scenery. She only spoke when we failed to take the turn that led back to San Antonio.
We going somewhere?
One more stop on the Les St. Pierre tour. His body, I hope.
I paused before answering, trying to keep down the irritation.
He's alive, Allison. Those deputy guys must have found him.
They found the cabin. Knowing Frank and Elgin, they blew the surveillance somehow. Let Les spot them before they spotted him. Les got out. He left Frank and Elgin sitting on the place, wondering when he would show up. That means Sheckley didn't kill Les, doesn't know where he is, and is anxious to find him.
That makes one of us.
We drove over the dam. On the left-hand side, the lake stretched out, twisted and glittery and dotted with little red racing boats trailing lines of wake. On the right-hand side, the dam's cement walls sloped down to a valley of limestone chunks and tiny scrub brush and a much-reduced Medina River, strained of everything except the sludge.
Les left in a hurry, I said.
Hmm.
He was using the cabin as a stopover, someplace to complete his paperwork, collect his funds, settle into his new identity. Since he was flushed out prematurely, he'd need a place to go.
Uh-huh.
I glanced over. Allison's head was starting to loosen on her neck, her jaw drifting up and down with the bumps in the road. She was frowning, and underneath the purple sunglasses, her eyes were closed. The wine bottle was empty. You okay?
I'm angry.
She said it calmly, her face so relaxed that she almost didn't look like herself. Les left you. You can be angry.
I didn't ask for your permission, Trace.
I raised my fingers off the steering wheel. No, you didn't. She wiped her cheek.
And I am not crying any tears for that bastard.
No, you aren't. We crossed the dam and headed around the east side of the lake. On the side of the road, barefoot fishermen were making their way back to their cars. College kids were loading their water skis onto trailers. Allison continued not crying over Les St. Pierre and wiping her cheeks furiously. I kept my eyes on the road. We were almost to the village of Plum Creek before she said,
"So where did he go?"
"What?"
"If he got chased away from his hidey hole before he was ready, where did he go? Hotel?"
"Too dangerous. Hotels remember long-term guests. There's a high risk he'd randomly run into somebody he knew. And he couldn't pay the bill without attracting notice, either by leaving a paper trail with a credit card or being conspicuous by using cash. No. More likely, he'd pick somebody he trusted to put him up for a while, a best friend.
Les has 40,000 of those.
But people he'd trust to hide him?"
"Julie Kearns," Allison decided. "Or the Danielses."
"The Danielses?" She nodded, stretching out her legs and crossing them at the ankles. She stared down at her feet, now bare and white and wrinkled from the lake.
"Les started out treating them like pets or something. You know, simple folk. They needed to be groomed and cared for. Eventually, he started lacking their company. Willis is a sweet old fart most of the time, and Miranda's an angel. And Brant's a good listener, a little self-destructive like Les. Les became attached to him pretty quick."
"But you and Brant," Allison shrugged.
"For the last month or so. I'm not sure Les knew, and I'm not sure he would have cared if he did. With me and Brant, it's just... it's not love or anything, sweetie."
She sounded like she was trying to reassure me, trying to explain away a minor illness she'd been fighting off.
"That the way Brant sees it?"
Allison laughed for the first time since we'd entered Les's cabin.
"I imagine Brant sees me as some kind of trial to get past. I guess you haven't spent much time around him, Trace. He's sweet. He's also sensitive as a raw blister with all the stuff that's happened to him. Tries to punish himself every time he thinks he might be enjoying life again. Been in his rut so long he's scared to come out, I guess. Sometimes I can't stand him. Sometimes it feels good to be with him."
"That's disturbing," I said.
"That I've slept with him?"
"No. Your assessment of who Les trusts enough to hide with.
Because
Julie Kearns was killed, and the Danielses... is this phone number what I think it is?" I read her the number on my hand, the last number that had been dialed from Les's cabin. Allison stared out the side window. It was a quarter mile or so before she said,
"The Danielses' ranch."
"Of course, it may have been dialed months ago," I said, "before Les disappeared. It may have been an ordinary call to a client."
"Hmm."
We drove along, both of us trying to get comfortable with that idea. We turned past the Plum Creek Dairy Queen. The boat storage facility was uphill, a good 50 yards from the water. It was a gravel clearing, fenced off with chain link and barbed wire, with a large drive-through gate.
Inside were storage sheds of corrugated metal and plywood, each just big enough to house a boat on a trailer. When I drove up, the gate was open and a family was hitching up their outboard to a Subaru four-wheeler. Or Mom was doing it anyway. The two kids were making like a trampoline in the back seat, and the dad was studying a Sports Illustrated swimsuit edition in the driver's seat. Allison and I got out and helped Mom get the hitch in place and connect the brake lights. Mom gave us a nice smile and asked if she should just leave the gate open. We said sure. Les's boat shed was A12. The chain and padlock on Les's shed door were new. Fortunately, the back wall of the shed was not. The metal peeled up easily on the bottom, giving us just enough space to crawl underneath. The walls of the shed didn't go all the way to the roof. There was about a foot of space at the top to let in light, enough to see by. Les's boat was just like Kelly Arguello had said, a 25-footer with a collapsed mast and the deck covered with a blue tarp. The tarp was tied on haphazardly, but with a lot of knots and enthusiasm. We finally had to cut our way through. I climbed onto the aft deck, then gave Allison a hand up. The bench seats on board were white rubbery material, embedded with silver glitter. There was a small empty cabin below, a closet, really. No way more than one person could fit down there. "Okay," Allison said. "So it's a boat. So what?" "Hold on." I went below and searched. Nothing. On the tank of a tiny toilet was a copy of Time. August, 3 years ago. Not encouraging. When I came back topside, Allison was prodding the deck floor with her foot. Whenever she pushed down, the blue plastic showed a square of seams about 2 feet by 2 feet. "Life vest compartment," I said. She and I exchanged looks. "Why not?" I agreed. 2 minutes later, we were sitting on the bench with an unearthed ice chest between us. It was a green igloo, big enough to hold 2 six-packs. When we opened it, there was no beer, though. There were stacks of money. $50 bills, the same as Milo had paid me with. About $50,000 worth. There was also a computer printout of addresses, some in San Antonio, some in Dallas and Houston. Next to each address was a date. In case of drowning, look up addresses, throw large quantities of money. Les St. Pierre, the safety-conscious ship's captain. Allison hefted a stack of 50s. "What the holy fuck?" "Later. Right now, we get this to the car." Allison looked dazed, but she helped me repack the ice chest, get it over the side of the boat, then wedge it under the storage unit's tin wall. On our way back to the Audi, each of us carrying one handle of the igloo, we left the gate open for another family that was coming in to collect their boat. Maybe they too were stashing money and addresses in their shed. They smiled and waved their thanks. I smiled back. Everyone is so damn friendly in the country. Chapter 40. The drive back started out well enough. Allison was coming off her 20 ounces of bad wine and was starting to warm up to the realization that we had $50,000 stashed under the back seat. By the time we got onto the highway, she was recapping the afternoon in glowing terms, throwing out casual insults about her idiot husband and the Avalon County Sheriff's Department. She suggested we drive out to Miranda's gig at the Paintbrush, see if we could find any more deputies to beat up. "But first, better clothes," she insisted. She tugged on my T-shirt sleeve. "I'm not going like this, and you've got to have cowboy boots." I've worn cowboy boots exactly once. It was not a success. "Tell?" "No, thanks." But she kept nagging until reluctantly. I told her about the photo my mother still shows off whenever I'm foolish enough to bring friends over. Me, 2 years old, thigh deep in the sheriff's black Lucchese, trying not to fall over, my cloth diaper sagging obscenely. Allison laughed. You're due for another try. We didn't tell Rhonda Jean at Shepler's Western Wear about the diaper photo. We didn't tell her we'd look so bad this evening because we'd been breaking into places all around Medina Lake. We just told her we needed a quick change of clothes before the store closed. In 15 minutes. Rhonda Jean smiled, a challenge. 14 minutes later, she had me outfitted in bootcut Levi's and a cotton-pieced red and white shirt and size 11 natural tan Justins. I vetoed the hat and the rattlesnake belt that she promised me she could have engraved with Trace on the back at no extra charge. Allison came out sporting a white fringed shirt and black boots and tight-fitting jeans that only a woman with an excellent figure could have gotten away with wearing. Allison got away with it pretty well. Rhonda Jean nodded her approval, then sent us on to the cashier. I paid with the last of the 50s Milo had given me at Tycoon Flats. Allison watched as I emptied my wallet.
You're paying out of pocket? With all we got stashed in the car?
The cashier gave us a very funny look. I smiled at Allison and said, Let's go, darling. Back in the Audi, we drove with the windows down. The wind was almost cool now, whipping around the front seats and sending the medicine pouch beads on the rearview mirror into a little jellyfish dance. Allison had taken off the sunglasses, and her eyes seemed softer and darker than they had been before. I was starting to turn some things around in my head, ideas about the addresses we'd found and the money and the trail Les St. Pierre had left. You know much about the record industry? I asked. Allison held her hands far apart, like she was bragging about a fish. 2 years with Les St. Pierre, cowboy? Well, you won't know. CDs. What about them? If you were importing them from overseas in large quantities, how would they be packed? Boxes? Crates? Spools. Cylinders? Yeah, big ones. The jewel cases and covers are only added in the destination country with local suppliers. It's cheaper that way. Why? So much for keeping the business modest.
What?
I waited a half mile before responding. We should talk about the money.
What's to talk about? Les was stupid enough to forget it when he ran. It reverts to me. You want a finder's fee, sweetie?
Les probably embezzled that money from the agency. Allison stared at me.
So?
So, it isn't yours. I'll store it for a while until I know what's what. Then, most likely, it'll go to the debtor's court.
You're kidding.
I didn't respond. We had come all the way back to Loop 410 to hit Shepler's and were now heading north again, ostensibly to go to the paintbrush. I missed the Leon Valley exit and kept driving, circling the city.
You're going to do Milo Chavez a $50,000 favor, Allison decided.
That's not what I said.
That's what it amounts to, bailing his ass out of debt and leaving me nothing. That's what you're thinking, isn't it?
I'm thinking you're overreacting again. Allison stomped her shiny new boot against the floorboard. She crossed her arms and looked out into the hills.
Shithead.
We passed I-10, kept going. I exited on West Avenue and turned left toward downtown. Maybe I should just take you back, I suggested. Let you collect your car.
Maybe so.
We drove in silence. West Avenue, Hildebrand, Broadway. Saturday night was unfolding all along the avenues, neon bar signs and low-rider cars and slow-cruising pickup trucks. The air was laced with the smell of family barbecues, pork ribs, and roasted peppers. When we finally got back to Queen Anne Street, I cut the engine and the lights. We sat there, staring at Allison's crookedly parked Miata, until Allison began to laugh. She turned toward me. Her breath smelled faintly of fortified wine.
All right. Don't get the wrong idea, sweetie.
What wrong idea is that? She reached over and pushed a couple of buttons on my new Western shirt.
That I didn't appreciate the day with you. I got a little upset, that's all. I don't want you thinking
the money is staying in storage, Allison.
She blinked slowly, processing what I said, then decided to laugh again.
You think that's all I'm interested in?
I don't know.
Fuck you, then.
She said it almost playfully. She leaned toward me slowly, tugging my shirt, inviting me to meet her halfway. Something twisted in my throat. I managed to move her hand away and say, "Not a good idea." She pulled back, raised her eyebrows.
"All right."
When she got out of the car, she slammed the door, then turned and smiled in the window at me.
"You and Milo have fun dividing up Les's estate, Trace. Thanks for the good time."
I watched her get in her car, start the engine, and pull off the curb with a grind and a thump, and drive away. I reminded myself that was really what I wanted. I sat in the dark Audi, leaned my head against the back of the seat, and exhaled. "Feel lucky," I thought. "You just spent 7 hours with that woman and neither of you shed any blood." But when I closed my eyes, they burned. I tried to replay our afternoon 10 different ways, going through all the placating things or the really nasty things I could have said. It made me feel even more dissatisfied and infuriated than I had been before. I should have gone out to the Indian paintbrush. I had plenty of new questions from Mr. Sheckley, some reports to give Milo, a lady to see who would be singing Billy's Señorita right about now, looking out at the audience with some very fine brown eyes. Instead, I got out of the car, my legs shaky from the long car ride, and wobbled toward my in-law apartment with the feeling that somewhere under the waterline, somewhere toward the prow, I had just been torpedoed.
Chapter 41. I tried to treat Sunday morning like the start of any other day. I did my Tai Chi, had breakfast with Robert Johnson, made a $50,000 deposit under my landlord's antique rosebush. Then I drove to Vandiver Street before anyone could be awake at my mother's house, left the Audi out front and the key in the mailbox, and reclaimed the VW. I headed south toward the State Insurance Building. If the tower had been downtown, it would have been invisible. But where it was, stuck in the middle of the flatlands south of SAC, surrounded by parks and one-story office complexes, it looked huge. The parking lot only had a handful of cars, one of them being Samuel Barrera's mustard BMW. I punched the elevator button for level 6 and was deposited in front of a frosted glass door that still bore faint discolored outlines from the stencil letters that used to read, "Samuel Barrera, Investigations." Now, there was a classy brass plaque above a classy ivory and gold buzzer. The plaque read, "ITEC." I didn't opt for the buzzer. I walked into the waiting room and went up to the little sliding window like they have in dentists' offices. The window was open. The receptionist was so short that she had to crane her neck to see me over the top of the counter. Her hair was mostly calcified hairspray that curled away from her face in capital letter U's. "Help you?" she inquired. I smiled. I straightened my tie. "Trace Navarre, I'm here to see Sam." She frowned. People weren't supposed to come in on Sunday morning asking for Barrera, especially by first name. "Won't you sit down?"
"I will."
The sliding glass panel shut in my face. I sat on the sofa and read the latest company bulletin from ITEC headquarters in New York. There was some propaganda about how well the company was doing, snapping up private firms in various states and selling them back to their owners, like McDonald's franchises. One ad, aimed at outside readers, told me exactly what it took to be ITEC material. I was just assessing my ITEC potential when the inner office door opened and Sam Barrera came out. He walked up to me and said,
"What the fuck do you want, Navarre?"
I put down the news bulletin. Barrera was wearing the standard three-piece suit, brown this time. His tie was a shade of yellow that miraculously matched. His gold rings were newly polished, and his cologne was strong.
We need to talk, I said.
No, we don't.
I went out to Medina Lake, Sam. The sunglass metal quality in Barrera's eyes got a little harder.
You will be talked to, Navarre, but it won't be by me. You'd better tell Irania.
There was more than a cabin out there, Sam. You missed something. Just for a second, Sam Barrera wasn't sure what to say. It had probably been years since anyone dared to suggest he had missed something. It had probably never come from an amateur half his age.
Parks and wildlife, I said.
Barrera processed quickly. His face went through a chameleon phase, red to brown to coffee color.
St. Pierre had a boat? He registered a freshwater boat?
Would you like to know what I found, or would you like to threaten me some more? He was quiet long enough for the cement in his expression to resettle.
You want to come in back?
He turned on his heel without waiting for my answer. I followed. Sam's office was a shrine to Texas A&M. The carpet was plush maroon and the drapes were the same. On the mahogany bookshelf, pothos plants were carefully interspersed with Aggie diplomas and photos of Sam and his sons in their Corps uniforms. On Sam's desk were photos of Barrera and his friends, law enforcement types, the mayor, businessmen. In one photo, Barrera stood next to my father. The sheriff's 76 campaign, I think. Dad was smiling. Barrera, of course, was not. Sam sat down behind his desk. I sat across from him in a large maroon chair that was strategically designed to be too cushy and low set. I had the feeling of being much shorter than my host, trapped in an interrogation cup.
Tell me.
Sam leaned forward and stared and waited.
Bootlegs, I said. Sheckley's been recording his headliner acts, creating master tapes in his studio, then shipping the tapes to Europe for production and distribution. More recently, he's gotten greedier, started to import the CDs back into the U.S. That's why you and your federal friends have been stepping up the heat.
Sam brushed my comments aside.
What was in the boat?
First, I want confirmation. Sam curled his fingers. The wrath of God built up behind his eyes, a collected, intense darkness meant to warn me that I was about to be smitten from the earth. He looked around his desk, maybe for something to kill me with, and focused instead on the picture of himself and the sheriff. Some annoyance crept into his expression.
I suppose you will continue to screw things up unless I level with you, Navarre, or unless I get someone to throw you in jail.
Most likely, God damn your father.
Amen.
Sam readjusted his belly above his belt line. He turned his chair sideways and stared out the window.
The scenario you described is commonplace. Frequently, someone at a venue records the shows. Frequently, the recordings turn up as bootlegs.
He waited to see if I was satisfied, if I would give in now. I just smiled. Sam's jaw tightened.
What is uncommon with the Indian paintbrush situation is the scale. Mr. Sheckley is presently recording something like 50 name artists a year. The master tapes are sent through Germany to CD plants, mostly in Romania and the Czech Republic, then distributed to something like 15 countries. More recently, as you said, his partners in Europe have been encouraging Mr. Sheckley to target the U.S. market, moving him from boots to pirates.
What's the difference?
Boots are auxiliary recordings, Navarre. Studio practice sessions, live recordings, cuts you couldn't get in the store normally. Sheckley's radio shows, for instance. Pirates are different. They're exact copies of legitimate releases. Boots can make money, but pirate copies undercut the regular market, take the place of legitimate work. They have massive potential. You make them well, you can even pass them off to major suppliers, department stores, mall chains, you name it.
And Sheckley's are good?
Barrera opened his desk drawer and got out a CD. He took the disc from the case and pointed with his pinky at the silver numbers etched around the hole.
This is one of Sheckley's pirate copies. The lot numbers on the SIDs are almost correct. Even if the custom officials knew what they were looking for, which they rarely do, They might pass this. The covers, once they're added, are four-color printing, quality paper stock. Even on the boots, Sheck's taken precautions. The liner notes are stamped manufactured in the EU. This is meant to make one think it's a legit import, explain the difference in packaging.
How profitable?
Barrera tapped a finger on the desk. Let me put it this way. It's rare that you have one syndicate controlling the manufacture and distribution of so many recordings in so many countries. The only similar case I know of, the IFPI, confiscated the receipts of an Italian operation. For one quarter, one artist's work, the pirates pulled in $5 million. It'd be less for country music, but still. Multiply the number of artists, four quarters a year, you get the idea.
Business worth killing for, I said.
What's the IFPI, International Federation of Phonographic Industries? European version of the RIAA in the States.
Your client.
Barrera hesitated. I never said that, you understand?
Perfectly. Tell me about Sheckley's German friends,
Luxembourg.
Pardon?
The syndicate is based in Luxembourg. Just so happens Sheckley made his connections in Bonn. Does most of his business in Germany.
I shook my head.
Help me out, Barrera. Luxembourg is the little country? The little country known for laundering mob money, yes. The little country known for maintaining loopholes in the EU's copyright laws. The pirates love Luxembourg.
I sat for a while and tried to process it. I was determined not to feel out of my league, not to show Barrera I was going to run from the room screaming if he gave me one more acronym.
Sheckley got himself into a dangerous association, I said. Barrera came the closest I'd ever seen to a laugh. It was a small noise in the back of his nose, easily mistaken for a sniff. Nothing else in his face moved.
Don't start shedding tears, Navarre. Mr. Sheckley's pulling down a few million extra a year.
But Blanc Eagle's murder and Julie Kearns...
Sheckley may not have ordered them, but I doubt he had much of a conscience attack. It's true, Navarre. Bootlegging is usually white-collar stuff, not very violent. But we're talking a large syndicate. Into gun running and credit card numbers and several other things.
And Jean?
Jean Kraus. He's beaten murder raps in three countries. One victim was a young French boy, about 13, son of Jean's girlfriend. He decided to lift some of Jean's petty cash. They found the kid in an alley in Rouen, thrown out a fifth-story hotel window.
Jesus.
Barrera nodded.
Kraus is smart, probably too smart to get caught. He's over here encouraging Sheck's CD distribution network in the U.S., It's only a matter of time before Jean and his bosses start using Sheckley's trucking lines for their other interests, guns especially. That's finally what got the DA and the Bureau and ATF interested. It takes a lot of fire stoking to get them excited about stolen music.
Your big league friends.
We've got a case for mail fraud in four states. Interstate commerce violations, orders placed and filled with some of Sheckley's distributors. Even that has taken years to assemble. To get a judge interested enough to grant access to Sheckley's bank statements and phone records. Throw in the fact that Avalon County law enforcement is in Sheckley's pocket. It's been tough going. 90% of a case like this has to be informants inside.
Les St. Pierre. He made himself your solution.
What?
Something his wife said. He was your in.
To Julie Kearns, yes, and Alex Blanc Eagle. And all three of them disappeared as soon as they started talking. We may lose the interest of the state's attorney's office if we don't get more soon. Something solid. Now, it's your turn. What was in the boat?
I took out the addresses I'd found in the ice chest, locations with dates next to them. I handed them to Barrera. Barrera frowned at the paper. When he was done reading, he looked out the window again, and his shoulders drooped.
All right.
They're distribution points, aren't they? Dates when shipments of CDs will arrive. Barrera nodded without much enthusiasm.
You've got locations, I prompted.
You know what Sheckley is doing.
You can stage a raid. Barrera said, We have nothing, Navarre. We have no grounds for requesting a search warrant, no evidence linking anyone to anything, just some random addresses and dates. Maybe eventually that information will lead us somewhere, not immediately. I was hoping for more. You've been building the case for what, 6 years? I asked. Barrera nodded. Chances are Sheckley knows, I said, or he's going to know soon that this information is compromised. You don't move on it now, they'll move the goods, change their routes, you'll lose them. I'll go another 6 years rather than get the case thrown out of court because we acted stupid. Thanks for the information. We sat quietly, listening to the A&M fighting Aggie clock tick on Barrera's back wall. One more thing, I said. I think Les fled to the Daniels's, or at least he considered it. I told Barrera about the phone call from the lake cabin. He'd be stupid to go there, Sam said. Maybe. But if I got the idea Les might have enlisted their help, Sheckley's friends could get the same idea. I don't like that possibility. I'll have someone go out and talk to the family. I'm not sure that will help the Daniels as much. There's nothing else I can do, Navarre, even under the best of circumstances. It'll be several more months before we can coordinate any kind of action against Mr. Sheckley. And if more people die between now and then? Barrera tapped on the desk again. The chances of the Daniels family getting targeted are very slim. Sheckley has bigger problems, bigger people to worry about. Bigger people, I repeated. Like 13-year-old boys who steal Jean Krause's petty cash. Barrera exhaled. His chair creaked as he stood up. I'm going to say what I said before, Navarre. You're into something over your head, and you need to get out. You don't have to take my word for it. I've leveled with you. Is this something an unlicensed kid with a couple of years on the street can handle? I looked again at the photo of Barrera and my father. My father, as in all his photos, seemed to grin out at me as if there was a huge private joke he wasn't sharing, almost certainly something that was humorous at my expense. Okay, I said. Okay, you're off the case. Okay, you've given me a lot to think about. Barrera shook his head. That's not good enough. You want me to lie to you, Sam? You want to go ahead and arrest me? Avalon County would approve of that approach. Barrera sniffed, moved over to his window, and looked out over the city of San Antonio. It was deadly still on a Sunday morning. A rumpled gray and green blanket, dotted with white boxes, laced with highways. The rolling ranchland beyond, a dark blue-green out to the horizon. You're too much like your father, Barrera said. I was about to respond, but something in the way Barrera was standing warned me not to. He was contemplating the correct thing to do. He'd have to turn around soon and deal with me, decide which agency he needed to turn me over to for dissection. He would have to do that as long as I was a problem, sitting in his office, telling him what was unacceptable to hear. I removed the problem. I stood up and left him standing by the window. I closed the office door very quietly on my way out. Chapter 42. The day heated up quickly. By 11, when I exited the highway for Ranch Road 22 in Bulverde, the clouds had burned away and the hills were starting to shimmer. I took the turn for Sarah Road, then drove over the cattle guard and pulled my VW under the giant live oak in front of the Daniels' ranch house. No one answered the front doors, so I walked around by the horseshoe pit. The backfield looked like a playground for the Army Corps of Engineers. Pyramids of PVC and copper pipes, crisscrossed trenches, mounds of caliche soil. The other night, it had been too dark to see the extent of the work.
Leaning against a utility shed out beyond the chicken coop were three metal canisters a little smaller than cars. Septic tanks. Two were dull silver and pitted with rust holes. The third was new and white, but caked here and there with clods of dirt, as if it had been improperly installed and then dug up again. The riderless backhoe squatted at the end of a trench, its shovel nuzzling the caliche. The backhoe was speckled with dirt and machine oil, but looked fairly new, painted the green and yellow of a rental company. I heard a tape playing out beyond the tractor shed. It was spare acoustic guitar and male vocal, like early Willie Nelson. I walked that direction. The horse in the neighboring field watched me with her neck leaning into the top of the barbed wire while she chewed on an apple half. When I got closer, I realized the tape I was hearing was one of the songs Miranda performed, only changed for a male singer. When I got around the other side of the shed, I realized I wasn't hearing a tape at all. It was Brent Daniels singing. He was sitting in one of two lawn chairs against the far wall of his tractor shed apartment, next to the chicken coop. He was facing the hills and strumming his Martin for the hens. His hair was tousled into a thin, wet, black mess like he'd just showered. He wore a T-shirt and denim shorts. There was a stack of Dixie cups and a bottle of Ryman whiskey on the tree stump next to him. He'd made a bold start on the bottle. He was singing his heart out, and for the first time, I realized just how good he really was. He didn't hear me coming up, or he didn't care. I stayed about 20 yards away and listened to him finish the song. He gave the impression that he was singing to somebody on the hilltop over on the horizon. When Brent finished, he let the guitar slide off his lap, then he picked up the whiskey bottle and poured himself a cup full. He slugged it down and glanced at me. "Navarre, I thought you were a recording." Daniels frowned. "You want Miranda. She's in Austin, mixing the demo. Willis is out getting more finger pipes." "In that case, mind if I join you?" He deliberated, like he wanted to say no, but was so out of practice turning down social requests that he didn't remember how. He held the stack of Dixie cups toward me. I took one off the top, then sat in the other lawn chair. You could see a long way off. The hills in the distance were green. The sky was blue the way amusement park water is blue, an unnatural, dyed-for-the-tourist kind of look, with foamy little scraps of cloud. A couple of turkey buzzards circled about half a mile to the north over a clump of trees. Dead cow or deer, probably. To the east, there was a brown zigzag of haze from someone's brush fire. The Ryman whiskey burned its way down my throat. "Les's brand, isn't it?" Brent shrugged. "He gives it out. Door prizes." I wanted to ask some questions, but the country air, the country mood, had started working on me. I realized how tired I was, how tired I'd been for the past few weeks. The midday sun was warm, but not unpleasant. Just enough to burn the last of the dew off the chicken wire and get some warmth into my bones. The hills invited quiet spectating. The reasons I'd come out to the ranch house started unknitting in my head. "You play out here often?" Some shadows deepened around Brent's eyes. "I suppose." "Y'all got another gig tonight?" He shook his head. "Just Miranda. She's got a show-up scheduled with Robert Earl Keene at Flores Country Store. I suppose Milo's gonna bring her back down for that." I dabbed the flakes of Dixie cup wax off the surface of the liquor. "Miranda doesn't drive at all, does she?" I hadn't even considered that fact until I said it. I hadn't questioned it Friday night, when I'd given her a lift into town, or the other times when she'd gotten rides with Milo or her father. The fact that I had just naturally accepted it, not even thought about it as odd, disturbed me for some reason I couldn't quite put into words.
"Not that you can't," Brent said. "She doesn't."
"Why?"
Brent glanced at me briefly.
declined comment. He picked up his guitar again and picked the strings so lightly I almost couldn't hear the notes. His hand changed chords fast, contorting into various claw shapes on the fretboard.
"You ever get frustrated with her playing your songs?" I asked. "Getting all the attention for your music?"
Brent kept playing quietly, looking at the hills as he worked his fretboard, occasionally twitching his eye as he reached for a harder note. His face and his hands reminded me of a deep-sea fisherman's as he worked his rod and reel.
"She was grateful at first," he said. "Told me she couldn't have done it without me, that she owed me everything. She gives you those bright eyes."
He smiled, a kind of sad amusement. Suddenly, he looked like his father, a leaner version, less gray, weathered a little sooner and a little more harshly, but still Willis's son.
"Guess you're the cavalry now, ain't you, Navarre?"
"You never thought much of Milo hiring a private eye."
"Nothing personal," he said. "Seems to me Les has ditched us. Milo's trying to prove he's got things under control. It's not... I appreciate..."
He stopped himself, not sure how to proceed.
"Miranda was talking about you yesterday. She seemed to feel a lot easier about things. Said you were a good man. I do appreciate that."
He meant it, but there was an uneasiness in his tone I couldn't quite nail down.
"Something about her Century Records deal is bothering you."
He shook his head uncertainly.
"Has Les tried to call you?"
Brent frowned.
"Why would he?"
"Just a thought. You don't figure he would have contacted Miranda?"
"Les is gone for good. That's pretty obvious, ain't it?"
"Is that what Allison's hoping?"
Brent played a few more chords. His focus moved farther away by a few hundred miles.
"It never should have happened between me and her."
"None of my business." Brent shook his head sadly. For no reason I could see, he decided to start singing again. It was a pretty tune, one of his slow ones. The Widower's Two-Step. Coming straight from Brent, the song was 100 times sadder. I could almost feel the weight of the tractor-shed apartment on his back. Imagine a young woman in there, pregnant, dying from some condition I couldn't even remember the name of. I got myself another Dixie cup full of whiskey. The liquor made a warm, heavy coating around my lungs. When Brent finished the last verse, we were quiet for a long time. The sun was nice. The circling buzzards and the horse pawing up the field, and even the frantic, coked-up movements of the chickens, were all getting more and more fascinating the more I drank. I could have settled into that lawn chair for the rest of my life, I figure.
"You get any money from the songs?"
I asked. Allison was saying something. Brent nodded.
"Quarter royalties."
"A quarter?"
"Half to the publisher."
"And the other quarter?"
"Goes to Miranda's co-writer."
"She co-wrote the songs?"
"No, but it's standard," Brent said. "The artist who records the song gets half credit for writing it, even if they didn't. Looks better on the album that way. It's a trade-off for them choosing your material."
"Even if she's your sister?"
"Les said it's standard."
I watched the turkey buzzards.
"Seems like Miranda could have made it unstandard."
He shrugged. I couldn't tell whether he cared or not. I wondered what conversations Allison had had with him about that.
"Les ever stay at the ranch house?" I asked.
He nodded reluctantly.
"Once. I was following him back from a gig one night. He run himself off the road from all the drink and pills. Had to convince him to come back here and sleep it off. He wasn't a happy fella. He talked a lot about self-destructing that night."
"How'd you handle it?"
Brent played a chord.
"Told him I'd been there."
He sang another song. I drank more. My feet were pleasantly numb, and I was enjoying the sound of Brent Daniels' voice. I felt easy and comfortable for the first time in days. Not thinking about whether I wanted to become a licensed PI or a college teacher or a neon blue bearded lady for Cirque du Soleil. Brent and I talked some more in between songs. It was like having a bilingual conversation, shifting in and out of singing and talking until there stopped being a difference. After a while, Brent started doing other people's music, Silver Wings and Faded Love, and Angel Flying Too Close to the Ground, stuff that reminded me of my dad's record collection. God forbid, maybe I even mumbled along with Brent as he sang. Things got blurry after that, but I remember during one of the silent places saying, "Les hasn't played straight with anybody this whole time. He wouldn't be worth protecting." I wanted to look at him, see his reaction, but my eyes were closed, and I was enjoying him that way. "I gave up on protection a long time ago," Brent said. His voice was a sad sound, the chords bright and airy behind it. The last thing I remember, he was singing something about a train. Chapter 43. I woke up with a feeling that somebody had hooked me to a reverse IV. All the fluid had drained out of my mouth and my eyes and my brain. When I moved my head, everything turned white. I realized, belatedly, that I was feeling pain. I sat up on the metal cot and rubbed my face where it had pressed itself into the texture of the rayon. One of the yellow curtains was open and light was pouring directly onto my chest. Other things came into focus. A folding card table with a bucket of silverware on it. A wooden bunk bed, the bottom bunk stripped to the springs. A Playboy wall calendar that was still stuck on Miss August. The walls were the same inside the little tractor shed apartment as they were outside, rough wood painted red. What few pictures there were hung from bare nails. Brent's carving knife was stuck directly into the wall above the tiny sink. There was no oven, no kitchen to speak of, just a hot pad and a coffee maker and a mini refrigerator. It was possible that a woman might have lived here once, but you couldn't have proved it. I tried to get up. I tried again. When I finally succeeded, I realized where all the fluid in my body had drained to. I looked around for the restroom. It was a tiny closet behind a shower curtain. Everything was close together. The sink overlapped the toilet tank, and the shower drained directly into the tile floor, so you could conceivably use the toilet and take a shower and brush your teeth all at the same time. I only tried option number one. It wasn't till I rummaged in the medicine cabinet, hoping for aspirin, that I found some reminder of the woman who had once lived here. Orange prescription bottles, at least 10 of them, all typed faintly with the name Marla Daniels. Insulin A, prenatal vitamin supplements, glucophage, several other names I had never heard of. Some were open, as if she'd just taken her prescription this morning, as if nothing had been touched in the cabinet in 2 years. In the corner, behind the container of white glucophage tablets, was a baby teether still in its plastic wrapper. I picked it up. Little glittery shapes, diamonds, squares, stars, floated through the liquid inside the plastic ring, sluggish and sterile. Behind me, Brent Daniels said, "You're up." I closed the cabinet. When I turned, Brent was trying his best not to notice what I'd been doing. He fingered the edge of the shower curtain. His hair had dried, and his face was clean-shaven. Except for the eyes, he didn't look like a man who'd been drinking as heavily as I had. "Miranda called," he told me. "Said Milo was going to be mixing for the rest of the afternoon and did I want to pick her up early. I could, or..." "I'll drive up." Brent nodded, like it was bad news he'd been expecting. He gestured behind him with his chin.
I followed him out into the apartment, which was just big enough for the two of us. Brent opened a cabinet above the little refrigerator and retrieved a bag of flour tortillas and a can of refried beans. Hungry? My stomach did a slow roll. I shook my head no. Brent shrugged and cranked up the hot pad. I stared at the picture that was taped inside the pantry door, a black and white of a woman with short brunette hair, a slightly moonish face, an almost uncontainable smile, like she was being tickled. That Marla? Brent tensed, looked around to see what I was talking about. When he realized I meant the picture, he relaxed. No, my mother. You were how old? He knew what I meant. Almost 20. Then, like it was something he was obliged to add, something he'd been corrected on many times, Miranda was only 6. Brent threw a tortilla directly on the hot pad. He watched as it began to puff up and bubble. The tortilla was probably old and flat, but after a minute on the grill, it would taste almost as good as fresh, the only correct way to heat a tortilla. Willis might not be too happy with you driving to pick Miranda up, he speculated. But you don't mind. He flipped the tortilla. One of the air bubbles had cracked open and the edges had blackened. Maybe I will take some, I decided. Brent made no comment, but got another tortilla out of the bag. I don't mind, he finally agreed. Dad, he trailed off. He's got an unpredictable temper, doesn't he? Brent was staring at the picture of his mother. Billy's Señorita, I said. The only song Miranda wrote herself. It was about your parents. Brent stirred up the refried beans. The fights weren't as bad as that. But scary to a 6-year-old. Brent stared at me. He let a little anger burn through the dead ash. You want to think about something? Think how Willis feels hearing that song every night. Put him in his place, all right. Work like a charm. I did what Brent said. I thought about it. Brent added a little pepper and a little butter and salt to the beans. When they were smoking, he spread them on the flour tortillas, folded them, and handed one to me. We sat and ate. I stared out the side window into the tractor shed. An enormous orange cat was sleeping on the seat of the rusty John Deere. A couple of doves were in the rafters above. My gaze shifted over to the ceiling above me. "What's up there?" I asked. "Attic now. Used to be the sewing room." "Sewing?" Brent looked at me.